Stage and Studio has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices his community has made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 5th, 11th, and 12th, 2 p.m. at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com. Appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org.
Good morning. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher. On today's show, we feature the world premiere of The Giver based on the book of the same title. Oregon's Children's Theater has developed a new play about a seemingly perfect society. Artistic director Stan Foote and the playwright will tell us more about it. And in the later part of the show, we feature 10 tiny dances by choreographer Mike Barber. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher, and I'm sitting in for Dima Roberts. With me in the KBOO studio is Stan Foote, Artistic Director of the Oregon Children's Theater. Good morning.
Good morning.
Last time you were here, you told Dima about this exciting new project that you were doing called The Giver. It sounded really controversial when you were describing it. A totalitarian world, free of war but fear. Where that no one had any choices. So can you give us more and fill us in and tell us more about it?
The beauty of Lois Lowry's book, The Giver, and the adaptation that Eric Coble has done for Oregon Children's Theater is that it presents a world that is safe, that everybody is the same, that people are content, their lives are drawn out for them, in such a way that they know what their life is going to be like. At the same time, you have a world with no choice, no love, no emotion. So you don't have sadness, but you don't really have happiness. You don't have pain, but you don't really have pleasure. So it's an interesting world. And for young people who read this book, a Newbery Award-winning book, it sparks conversation and discussion and engages their imagination to have hours and hours of discussion about this world and how important those things are in their lives.
Well, The Giver is a favorite book among middle and high school students. And so touch on what some of those themes would be.
For different ages, they're different themes. So for me at 53 years old, I immediately saw a world where I had no political choices and my freedom of speech was taken away. For a fifth grader, it might be a world where there's no love and they don't have emotions. For a high school student, it might be a world where the discipline of the world is radical and rash. It's a three strikes you're out world in The Giver's world. It depends on where you're at. The beauty of the book is there are discussions to be had about politics, about families, about protecting your children, about what children should know and what children shouldn't know, about...
Which in and of itself is a discussion topic.
Exactly. The whole book just brings about so many things that are ripe for discussion. I've spent 2 hours with Fowler Middle School 7th graders yesterday, and we talked about what it's like to control your emotions, which is exactly what happens in The Giver's world. Everybody controls their emotions. It's impolite to be rude. It's impolite to question. And you always apologize when you offend someone. It's not that the apology has any meaning. It's like a ritual apology. I apologize for causing you this pain. And then they say, I accept your apology, and it's all done. But the fact is, there's so much emotional control going on that the vibrancy of their lives is limited. And these students were talking about how they had to control their emotions to fit in with their fellow students. And some were saying, we don't need to control our emotions because we need to be ourselves. That's part of our personality. And others were saying, we have to control our emotions or else
we're in trouble.
Bad things will happen to us or people won't like us. And so it sparks these conversations about their life. So this futuristic world, they reflect right back to their life. It's really interesting that there are parents dying to have communication with their children, and here's this perfect vehicle if they just knew about the book. But the kids keep it to themselves. They say, oh, The Giver, this is our book. So they might say, I'm reading a good book. But if the parent picks it up, then all of a sudden there's this magic world open for them to say, well, how do you feel about this? What do you feel about what's happening here? How did you feel about one of his rules being you can lie? And how do you feel about a world that doesn't think about the path they're on by the memories of past civilizations? What do you think about that?
Very timely and topical.
Very exciting information.
Yeah. With us on the phone is the playwright who did the adaptation, Eric Coble. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
Oh. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Stan.
For you, what was the major challenge for you as a playwright to adapt this book?
I think it was picking out the... it was just paring it down because there's so much richness there and so much depth, and knowing that we had to present it in a presentational way that had to be seen and had to be within a certain time limit and couldn't just be picked up and put down and thought about and, couldn't be read over the course of weeks or a month, and how to tell that story compactly and still get as much of the meat of it as possible, I think was the real challenge.
Well, so for either of you, is it true to the book or did you have to fill in the blanks and cut out a lot of material?
I think it's very true to the book. That was one of our real goals from the beginning. I checked in with Stan when he asked about adapting it, was that we want anyone who's going to come see this, we assume, is coming to see Lois Lowry's The Giver, and they're not coming to see Eric Coble's The Giver. So we really wanted to maintain, to be as true to her story as possible. And again, because she raises such rich issues, that we want to bring as many of those to the discussion table as possible. We had to trim things out, but we did not have to add anything. We really tried to stay as true to the book and certainly to the characters, and most of the dialogue, as we possibly could.
Great. Well, how did you both, in working on the play, balance the issues in the play with the sensitivities that some of the parents in the audience might feel about their kids watching this? I mean, that must have been pretty tricky for both of you to kind of recognize, and the responsibility of, like you said about earlier, Stan, about the kids kind of wanting to possess this book themselves, but being a vehicle that they could expand on with their parents. So how did you address those sensitivities?
Do you want to take that one, Stan?
Oh, sure.
Either of you, both of you had a part in this.
Eric truly wrote Lois Lowry's book. Lois Lowry commented on Eric's adaptation. She said she thought it was great. So for me, it's being true to a generation that has ownership in this book, and not to sugarcoat the material, but also not to be brutal on stage. The whole idea of the memories that the giver gives to the receiver, to Jonas, is that the world is sort of a yin and yang world. There are very good things and there are very bad things. And without knowing the bad things,
how can you appreciate, understand, or...
Yeah, how can you enjoy the richness of the good things? So that's the way the book works. So I think we tried and I think we succeeded in keeping this neutral path, just like the book presents, of... here's the good stuff, and here's the bad stuff, and here's the ending of the book, and you have to make decisions as an audience member, and you have to make decisions as a reader of what this means to you, what the outcome is, and what are the important things to discuss. So we tried to go down this path that represents a lot of different visions. I worked with 20 young people this summer who told me what they thought the book was about and talked to the set designer and the costume designer and said what it should look like. So
getting their feedback.
Yeah, we really wanted their view of what this world was like and tried to get into their heads about what they thought was important.
Mm-hmm. And Eric, what can you add something to that?
I agree with everything that Stan said. I think too that it was part of it was trying to find a graceful way to deal with all that, with such immense beauty and such immense horror. How to do that in a subtle, graceful way on stage, where and let the audience, because it's theater. I mean, we have the real advantage, I think, of letting the audience fill in the gaps and bring their own imaginations to the table. So if we suggest some of the most spectacular beauty and some of the deepest love, and we suggest some of the most horrific things you can imagine, the audience can go on, can fill in as far as they're comfortable filling in. We don't have to throw anything in their faces and make them experience this. Their own imagination will fill it in very personal ways for them, beyond ways that Stan or I or the set designer or anyone else could imagine. And so I think that we try to leave a lot of it to the audience, and then and again to just lead them up to the questions and as a point of discussion, so that, which as Stan said, includes the really wonderful and the really bad, and if that leads to controversy, then it leads to controversy, but at least it's being discussed. It's better than not leading to controversy in some ways.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, and we'll let you go and continue with Stan, but we wish all great things for you and all the other up-and-coming project that you've got and coming up. And, you know, we really appreciate you taking your time out to speak with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right.
See you later, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. You're listening to Stage and Studio, and I'm Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher, and I'm just talking with playwright Eric Coble on the phone, and in the studio, artistic director Stan Foote, both of the Oregon Children's Theater production of The Giver, which opened last Sunday and runs for two more days this weekend on the 11th and the 12th. How did the opening go?
We opened first for 6,000 school children last Friday, and they sat and quietly watched the whole show and burst into applause at the end of it. Young people are eager for this type of material. They're eager to be thought of as intellectual human beings with opinions and able to discuss topics.
And respected.
And they went crazy about it. So it went very well. And then the public opening went very well with adults in the audience bringing their handkerchiefs out and sometimes weeping and sometimes laughing and walking out ready to talk about everything in the show. So theater is a catalyst for discussion. Art-provoking discussion is not just an adult thing. The world of children's theater is about stimulating topics and not trying to force a point of view. It's really getting the discussion out there with young people. And I urge people, if they have a young person in their house, this is a perfect way to have at least a half an hour discussion about what you just saw.
A timely, important, in-depth
discussion about the world they live in. Yeah.
Which oftentimes I don't think we give them enough credit, you know, for understanding and having to respond to it. And although, like you say, the themes start out with the natural inclination of a parent to be protective, to want that all perfect, all wonderful, all easy world. And then you move to reality and go, but I need to give them the skills, the understanding to critically take apart and think about the real world that they live in.
Exactly. And I think the book serves as a metaphor, a catalyst to do that. I think if you walked in and you said to your child, what do you think about war? They'd say, what? What? You know, and if you see The Giver and you say, what did you think about that war scene? And they'll say, war is really horrible. People suffer. We should think about when we go to war.
Out of the mouths of babes?
Yes. I mean, I heard seventh graders say it yesterday. You know, I asked them the question, should young people know about the realities of war? And one young man stood up and said, there are people coming back from war with no arms, no legs. And we need to know that so that if we say, yes, we should go to war, we realize this is what
the
war causes.
The consequences.
Yeah, and it's not pro this or anti that. It is the realities of the world need to be part of their conversation because they're going to be decision makers.
Absolutely. I see at your site at octc.org, you have a page for kids and a page for parents and a blog as well. And there's actually a discussion starting to happen about the play there.
Exactly. We have actually a separate site, too, which is www.thegiverishere.com. And it has a blog site on it and a way to buy tickets and way for parents to learn about the material in the book and way for kids to discuss with each other what's going on. It's a really exciting...
Now, let me interject here. It's recommended for ages 10 and up.
Exactly.
Okay.
There is stuff in the play. There are scenes in the play that are disturbing. They are disturbing. It's part of the world that Lois Lowry has created where you
find it's part of the world.
Yeah, and it's part of the world. And you as a reader and you as an audience member are seeing it from Jonas's, our protagonist's point of view. And he is disturbed, and you should be disturbed when that happens. It is what causes him to want to change things. And that want to change, I think, is a really valuable skill in young people. We need to want to make our world better. That's a need for all of us, but especially young people need to know, yes, it's possible that one person, one group, one community can change the want to change and the reasons why.
And it's truly almost the mandate of youth because, as you say, the energy, the effort, and the time, the commitment that they make is, in fact, altering the world that they will, in fact, live in and share. I think it's really empowering.
I'm very optimistic after talking to so many young people over the past year because I've been working on this for a year. I got the rights to adapt over a year ago and started asking young people, have you read this book? Yes, I read it 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade. I said, you were assigned it in that many grades? No, I was assigned it in the 6th grade.
And revisited it.
And revisited 7th, 8th, 9th grade. It's a powerful book for them. It's a book of a generation right now. It's been out about 10 years. It won the Newbery Award. And it's been assigned. They read it. They love it. They have their copies. And they're ready to discuss what they think.
Well, and I will attest to having 21-year-olds and friends that are 18 and 19 that say the same thing, that they grew up with it, they lived it, they understand it, they appreciate it. It helped them be able to navigate the world in which they are, you know, which they are inheriting.
Right. And you don't have to be. We've had adult pairs come to see the show. You don't have to be a young person. The production values and the quality of the show are outstanding. When you walk into the theater, you're going to go, wow, this is not big stuffed animals like you think. It's not a clown doing balloon animals, what you think about children's theater usually. It is a magnificent production that will stimulate every aged person that walks in. There's themes for senior citizens to consider in this book. There's themes for parents. There's themes for all of us about our world and how we want it to be.
Well, I know that Dee May wants to, and in her absence, I certainly do want to thank the Children's Theater for doing and hard-hitting and thought-provoking plays like this one, and I want to encourage you to keep it up. I'm sure it's a big challenge, but I think the rewards are, for you and for the rest of us are really there. I want to remind our listeners, in the remaining time, we're running short on time, but I want to also get an opportunity. Well, first of all, let me remind everybody that the Oregon Children's Theater presents the world premiere of The Giver March 11th and 12th, and that all performances 2 p.m. and are at the Keller Auditorium. The tickets for adults are 10 to 22. Tickets for students under age 15 or seniors over 62 are $10 to 17. And you can call at 503-228-9571 Monday through Friday, or you can go to Ticketmaster. And I also wanted to say that we are going to have a pair of tickets to give away at the end of the program at 503-231-8032. In our little bit of remaining time, I wanted to ask you about any other projects that are up and coming. That you've got just a few minutes to let us know about something new that might be after this that you want to get an opportunity to speak about.
Our next show is for our younger members of our audience, Alexander, who is not going to move, but if we're trying to attract this young teen audience. So next season we will be doing Red Badge of Courage, four-person cast with a hip-hop sort of theme, a rapper doing the inner monologue of the protagonist within that. So it's a very contemporary version, again, reaching out to that audience and trying to connect.
Doing the very thing that I am applauding you for.
The ideas, yeah, connect the ideas to a young person's mind. Theater needs to reach out to young people of all ages. We have a responsibility at Oregon Children's Theater to reach from 4 to 18 years old. And if you're in Europe, you know, youth is considered up to 25 years old. I encourage anybody that wants to have a stimulating time to come and see The Giver.
Well, again, I can't thank... Okay, we do have a winner on the ticket, so thank you so much for calling. Again, I can't thank you enough for being here. I've been speaking with Stan Foote, the artistic director of Oregon's Children's Theater. And, again, thank you for taking on the big issues and engaging this really important part of the population that I think sometimes gets overlooked and, dismissed without the respect for the complexity that they really can and want to engage in.
And I would like to thank all the young people that have talked to me over the last year about this book and encouraged me to see their vision of what the world should be.
Thank you so much. Again, for any information, you can call at 503-228-9571. And the tickets are for the performances, 2 p.m. at the Keller Auditorium, the world premiere of The Giver, March 11th and 12th. And again, Stan, thank you so much for being here. And it was a pleasure to speak with you. And I'm excited about what you're doing next. And we'll have you back.
Thank you. Get well, D-May.
Yeah, get well, D-May. Next up is 10 Tiny Dances by Mike Barber after this break. Stage and Studio, and I'm Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher sitting in for D-May Roberts. Choreographer and dancer Mike Barber began a project he thought was going to be a one-time, I'll invite my friends and put on a show kind of event. Well, that event, titled 10 Tiny Dances, now approaches its 10th installment, and with more than 54 artists, 8 venues, 77 new dances, 2 cities, and over 1,000 audience members later, it's still going strong. This year, 10 Tiny Dances is at the Wonder Ballroom. The artists include some of the best dancers and choreographers in town: Mike Barber, Margareta Hansen, Anne Forfait, Mary Oslin, Linda Austin, Jose Mosley, Tracy Broyles, Sydney Wilkes, Min Tron, and Gabriel Mason. Roberts talked with Mike Barber last year about this project.
This began as a way to, as a party, to raise funds for a show I was doing, and it ended up being very, very successful in the event.
So it really is a 4-foot by 4-foot stage.
4 by 4 feet and 18 inches high.
Wow. Wow. So that's not very big at all.
It's about confined space.
Yeah. And you have 10 choreographers.
Uh-huh.
And I'm getting this picture. You were at a party and somebody, you know, did they have like a 4x4 stage or something?
No. It was a party that I planned. I was looking for a way to do a unique kind of fundraiser for the first one. The wine bar Crush had just opened and thought it was a fun space and had kind of a buzz around it and thought, well, I'll make a little stage and we'll do it in this really packed place and thought that would create some good energy around it and some interest, and it did.
Well, what is the challenge about confined spaces of performing in something that's so small?
You know, I've learned about that as I've gone. I think there's something that happens, there's a freedom that comes from the confinement. Dancer choreographers have responded to this in different ways, but I have found that by working in a small space and being confined, you're in a crucible, if you will, or a container that can hold the energy, and it gives you something to bounce against, gives you boundaries and limits. So limits your choices in some ways, but also creates new ways of thinking as well. So there's a balance there between some kind of disparate ideas of confinement and freedom. I think there is a creative freedom that comes from having to work in confinement.
That it boggles me. So the pieces can be very different.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, it's one of the best things about the event for the public is that they get such a presentation of such a wide range of dance and performance art all in one setting. And each of the experiences are small, you know, or are palatable. So they'll see in a two-hour event, they'll see 10 different pieces of art and all very, very different, but all united by this idea of each of the artists have had to deal with the confined space.
Now, are they in a room, or is it just a plywood board?
Well, it's just a board. It's just the 4x4-foot platform.
That is amazing. And how do you come up with a different idea?
For the tiny stage?
Yeah.
Well, lots of different ways. Sometimes it's music. Sometimes it's wanting to manipulate the stage in a different way.
Wow. Well, it just sounds like a mind bender to me. So I'm glad that it's so successful that you've been able to do this for all these years and also all these times.
It's been great.
Have you had some good funding for this too?
Funding has been a challenge because I'm not. It funds itself, which was part of my original design, was to do this in a way that it wasn't overwhelming to me. To me, it was an easy thing to produce, and had kind of big payback, you know, in terms of the audience as well as creative opportunity for the dancer, for the artist as well.
So you're totally funded by admissions to the door?
It's funded by admissions.
Mike Barber, thanks so much for joining us on this tiny phone line.
You're welcome, Dima.
Good luck on both shows. You take care.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dima Roberts talking about 10 Tiny Dances, produced by Mike Barber. Friday, March 17th at St. Patrick's Day at 8 and 10:30 p.m. The show's at the Wonder Ballroom, 128 Northeast Russell Street. Tickets are available through Ticketmaster at 503-224-4400 or at the Wonder Ballroom box office, also at the door. For more information, you can call 503-331-0436. And that's it for Stage and Studio this week. Next week, Dima will be back, and I hope she's feeling better, with the original production of the Mark at Stark Raving Theater. This has been Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher, KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
This is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from London.
I'm a British serviceman that would like to say this. We should not take part in this war. Every British and American soldier should conscientiously object to this war because it is immoral, bankrupt, and wrong.
Today we speak with George Salamo, the first soldier to urge mass refusal to soldiers serving in Iraq. And his new video is broadcast of the abducted members of the Christian peacemaker teams in Iraq. We'll speak with a member of the CPT. But first, Lawless World, the whistleblowing account of how Bush and Blair are taking the law into their own hands. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from London. I'm Amy Goodman. Al Jazeera has broadcast new video of three of the four abducted members of the Christian peacemaker teams in Iraq. The silent 25-second footage carried a superimposed date of February 28th, 1 week ago today. British citizen Norman Kember and Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan were shown. U.S. citizen Tom Fox of Virginia was not on the tape. According to Al Jazeera, the men asked their governments to work for their release. The hostages were last seen all together in a video released January 28th, dated 1 week earlier. This weekend, the 100-day anniversary of their abduction was marked with vigils around the world. The peacemakers' kidnappers initially threatened to kill them unless all prisoners in U.S. and Iraqi detention centers were released. In other Iraq news, Britain's top military commander in Iraq has announced plans to withdraw nearly all of its soldiers by the summer of 2008. In an interview with the Daily Telegraph newspaper, Lieutenant General Nick Houghton said phased withdrawals would begin within weeks. However, Houghton said the pullout is ultimately contingent on Iraqi lawmakers forming a national coalition government and U.S. and British governments judging the Iraqi military ready to handle security. There are currently 8,000 British troops in Iraq. Meanwhile, the head of the Iraqi Army's Baghdad division was killed Monday when his vehicle came under attack. Major General Mabdar Hatim Hazia al-Dulaimi is one of the highest-ranking Iraqi military officials to lose their lives in insurgent violence. A U.S. military commander who oversaw the U.S. military contingent in Baghdad last year said of the general's death, quote, "It could be a blow that takes a long time to overcome." The incident was one of several Monday that left more than 20 people dead and 50 injured around Iraq. In the day's worst attack, five children were among seven people killed in a bombing in a crowded market in the town of Bakuba. Another 17 people were injured. In comments, the Los Angeles Times calls among the frankest and bleakest public assessments of the Iraq situation by a high-level American official. U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad has warned of a full-blown civil war. Referring to the recent bombing of the Shia shrine in Samarra, Khalilzad said, quote, "If another incident occurs, Iraq is really vulnerable to it at this time." Khalilzad went on to say, quote, "We have opened the Pandora's box, and the question is, what is the way forward?" His comments come just days after General Peter Pace, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said things were, quote, "going very, very well in Iraq." Here in Britain, The Guardian of London is reporting the government has admitted aircraft thought to be used for the CIA's transfer of detainees has landed at local military airfields. The practice, known as extraordinary rendition, has raised public outcry across Europe over the use of its territory to transfer detainees who face torture. After months of silence on the issue, the British government disclosed the CIA landed 14 times at two bases between October 2003 and May 2004. In other news, the United States has dismissed the possibility of reaching a compromise in the international standoff over Iran's nuclear ambitions. Iran has been in talks to move its nuclear enrichment activities to Russia. The U.S. announced its stance after U.N. International Atomic Energy Agency head Mohammad al-Baradei said a deal between Moscow and Tehran could prevent Iran's referral to the U.N. Security Council. Meanwhile, U.N. Ambassador John Bolton has escalated talk of a possible U.S. attack on Iran. The Guardian of London reported Monday Bolton issued the threat at a meeting with British parliamentarians last week. According to one participant, Bolton said, quote, They must know everything is on the table and they must understand what that means. We can hit different points along the line. You only have to take out one part of their nuclear operation to take the whole thing down, he said at a speech at the annual gathering of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, this Sunday. Bolton said the U.S. must be prepared to, quote, use all the tools at our disposal to stop the threat that the Iranian regime poses. In the occupied territories, five Palestinians were killed Monday in an Israeli airstrike on Gaza City. The attack killed two members of the Palestinian group Islamic Jihad and three bystanders. Two of those killed were children aged 8 and 15 years old. An uncle of one of the dead who lived nearby also died of a heart attack. Another 8 people were wounded. Meanwhile, in Israel, Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz defended Israel's policy of targeted killings and warned any Hamas leader could be hit. Mofaz said, quote, if Hamas, a terror organization that doesn't recognize agreements with us and isn't willing to renounce violence, presents us with the challenge of having to confront a terror organization, then no one there will be immune. Referring to Hamas's prime minister designate, Mofaz went on to say, quote, not just Ismail Haniyeh, no one will be immune, he said. In military news, the U.S. Army has announced a new review of the death of former football star turned U.S. Ranger Pat Tillman. Tillman made headlines when he quit the NFL to fight after the September 11th attacks. He died while serving in Afghanistan, April 2004. The military initially misled his family into believing he was killed in battle, when in fact he was killed by U.S. troops. Tillman's death has already been probed on 3 separate occasions, but have only resulted in light punishment for some of his fellow soldiers. The new probes will focus on both the details of his shooting and allegations the Army covered up crucial facts after he was killed. A military spokesperson said earlier investigations had produced enough evidence to warrant possible charges of negligent homicide. In South Dakota, Governor Mike Rounds has signed legislation to ban all abortions in the state unless they're performed to save the life of the woman. Rounds said he expects a lengthy court battle over the new law. The measure comes as a similar effort is moving ahead in the state of Mississippi. In other news, the Supreme Court has ruled military recruiting must be allowed on college campuses that accept federal funding in a unanimous ruling. Justices rejected a free speech challenge from law schools that said they shouldn't be forced to accept recruitment so long as the military maintains a don't ask, don't tell policy on gay men and lesbians. The schools maintain the policy is discriminatory. At The Hague, a former Croatian Serb leader jailed for crimes against humanity has committed suicide. Milan Babic was serving a 13-year sentence after admitting to suppressing the non-Serb population in Croatia's Krajina region. Once an ally of Slobodan Milosevic, Babic testified against the former Yugoslav president at his ongoing trial. In Bolivia, President Evo Morales has accused the United States of blackmail for withdrawing $300,000 in grants. Morales said his country was told last week it's no longer considered a partner in the so-called war on terror.
We are under obligation to inform ourselves on this form of blackmail, threats, and intimidation to our armed forces. Because we don't accept vetoes or the change of a commander, blackmail comes from the U.S. Armed Forces.
President Morales won the presidency in Bolivia in December with more popular support than any Bolivian president in decades. He has drawn opposition from the Bush administration for his pledge to nationalize the country's vast natural gas reserves and his opposition to the U.S.-funded eradication of the coca crop. In New York, Cindy Sheehan and 3 other women were arrested at anti-war protest on Monday. Sheehan and the others were part of a march of U.S. and Iraqi women at the headquarters of the United Nations. The group attempted to deliver a petition signed by close to 70,000 people calling on the withdrawal of all troops and foreign fighters from Iraq. They were arrested for criminal trespass and resisting arrest. In other news, a group of environmental and civil rights groups has asked the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to investigate whether victims of Hurricane Katrina and workers employed in Gulf Coast reconstruction are being adequately treated by the U.S. government and federal contractors. Monique Hardin, co-director of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights in New Orleans, said, quote, 6 months have passed and these communities still look like the hurricane hit yesterday. And in Los Angeles, a group of urban farmers say they've won a court order to delay their eviction from land they've tended for over 30 years. Tenants of the South Central Farm are battling Los Angeles and a local real estate developer who plans to build commercial property on the land. The 14-acre property hosts the largest urban farm in the United States. 350 families use the farm to grow a multitude of crops. The stay will be in effect until at least next Monday. In a statement released on their website, www.southcentralfarmers.com, the group said, quote, to our knowledge, we can only be guaranteed to stall the eviction for days. This week will be critical in the history and fate of the farm. The farmers have been keeping up this fight for 3 years, but its victory is in the hands of the people, the statement said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from London on more than 400 radio and television stations around the United States, Canada, Europe, Australia. We're broadcasting on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. I'm Amy Goodman.